Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
So we're going to roll out right away with an email, because this email just was perfect for rolling into what I was first planning to talk about, and that is this intermittent fasting. This is sort of, we are a culture of fads, and the internet has accelerated that, so I've been getting a lot of questions about this intermittent fasting. And this from Anne. Intermittent fasting. I find it fairly easy to fast 12 to 16 hours a day, except for wanting some soy milk in my coffee in the morning, a quarter cup or a little bit less. Does that negate the fast? And while the jury is still out on this completely, most people would say, maybe. And it really depends upon how important it is to stay ketotic. Now, this fasting concept is linked to a physiological state where your body is burning little two carbon fragments of long fatty acid chains. And these two carbon fragments are called ketone bodies. And you want to be burning ketone bodies. So if you, the thing that turns off the burning of ketone bodies is insulin above its baseline level. And the best way to raise your insulin levels is to consume a carbohydrate, which unfortunately is found in soy milk. I'm thinking a quarter cup of soy milk is probably, depending upon whether there's sweetener, and there's sweetener in most of them, you're probably looking at something like 30 to 40 calories of carbohydrate, and that's off the top of my head, but I think I'm in the right ballpark. And that's kind of right on the edge of what might kick your insulin off and turn up ketosis. So until we know more, I think it's really reasonable to play around with butter and medium chain triglycerides, so-called MCT oil, for your choices here. And what I'm saying is that you want to try maybe stevia, and I don't like stevia in coffee, so I will kind of bite the bullet and use a little NutraSweet or a little Splenda. And effectively, if you want to stay ketotic, you really need about 16 hours, at least most of us, unless you're eating a very, very high-fat diet. And I don't recommend that, by the way, unless you're doing it for a brief period of time or you have some exceptional circumstances. I don't think walking around with a ketogenic diet is the optimum diet for humans, although we can adapt to it. That adaptation takes weeks, and it's just the first little bit of, you know, one cookie will ruin your adaptation, and you'll revert back, and it'll take days probably to get back to that adaptation. So you don't want to do that. However, the fasting, I think, can be very useful. The idea of having an 8 to 9 hour feeding window is often called a fasting mimicking diet, because you're really not fasting as in nothing but water for days at a time. But when they have deprived animals, lab animals, all the way up to chimpanzees, and given them inadequate calories for their body weight, they get longer-lived chimpanzees, and presumably we would get longer-lived humans. There's a guy named Victor Longo who's promoted this, and I think that it's a reasonable strategy, this fasting, and I think it mimics what our lives were probably like during much of human history, and that's always for me a good sign. I like to stay within, let's call it, the evolutionary window, unless something is giving me a very, very good reason to step outside of the evolutionary window. So your basic daily carbohydrate need is about 130 grams. And you don't want, that's per day, by the way, that's 24 hours. You don't want a high carbohydrate breakfast, because that triggers an insulin spike, then your blood sugar drops, and then that wakes up your liver, and the liver starts making sugar. And your liver should never do that while you're awake. Your liver will only do that if there's a spike in insulin and then a rapid blood sugar drop. And if you eat a high protein, high fat breakfast, that's not going to happen. So your body gets more sensitive throughout the day. So you can eat your carbohydrates at night and it'll actually help sleep. As far as the carbohydrates go, the midday meal can be moderate carbohydrates and it needs to be measured. You don't want to go above 20 grams of carbohydrate if you can possibly avoid it. And that's like 80 calories worth of bread. So, you know, if you eat a sandwich, that's going to get you in trouble as far as the optimum diet goes. So really, one needs to cut back on carbohydrates until the evening, and you can have them then, and they have less of an adverse effect because you're not going to keep eating, and you're about to go to sleep, and at that point, your liver is going to start to make glucose anyway, because once we finish digesting our food, there's no more glucose coming in, and it has to come from somewhere, and it comes from the liver storage. It's really important to stop eating at least 2 hours before bedtime for a lot of reasons, but a main one is to avoid reflux and to be sure that you absorb and digest properly. So I wanted to segue from this to talking about protein as we age, because there's a kind of one-size-fits-all recommendation out there. If you look up, quote, protein requirements, you're going to say, oh, you're going to see it's that the recommendation is 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. But that's really not a particular evidence-based thing when you think about it, because they're doing this study in 20-year-old males, because they do all the studies in 20-year-old males, because God forbid there should be anybody else on the planet. And there's some practical reasons for that. First of all, they work cheap. Second of all, they don't get pregnant. And, you know, God forbid you should be doing an experiment on a pregnant woman and she should have a pregnancy complication, because you can you know, it's spelled L-A-W-Y-E-R, and every institution that might want to run a study is really afraid of L-A-W-Y-E-Rs, and so that's just not going to happen. Thus, our science is intrinsically flawed. We don't do it in old people, and we don't do it in women. And if we were, and when we do go back and redo things in those two subgroups, we get different data. So there's a group called the European Union Geriatric Medical Society. And it is essentially a EU-wide organization of geriatricians. And they appointed an international study group to look at the literature and review dietary protein needs with aging. And this group went and looked at the science, because there is some. And they say that for older people above the age of 65 to maintain or regain lean body mass, they need at least 1 to 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day. So if you think about that, that's 50% more than the recommended dose. So if you're living on Ensure, first of all, that's terrible stuff. You really don't want to live on these meal boosters. You want to use them in isolated circumstances when you literally can't eat anything else. And if you're in a hypermetabolic state, like you're fighting off the flu or you're running a fever, those are the moments when your body can use all of those extra quote-unquote empty calories. So if you have chronic disease, so let's suppose you have heart disease or you have diabetes, you need even more dietary protein. This European study group, it's called the ProtAge study, PROT-AGE. If you Google that, you'll find a very nice consensus statement. And the study group consensus statement says that if you are a sick person over 65, you need 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilogram of body weight. And this is to avoid frailty. And we've all seen what a frail elder looks like. We may have seen someone we love or hold close turn into a frail person. And one of the things that you see is pretty substantial weight loss and weakness. Because unfortunately, a lot of the weight that's lost is from the muscle compartment, not from the fat compartment. If you have severe kidney disease, you may have to use other recommendations. So a lot of people are walking around with, oh, I have kidney disease, because they have a GFR under 60. And this is the speed with which your kidney, or the rate with which your kidney can cleanse the blood, called GFR. It's a filtration rate. So one of the most important things here with the GFR is that you need to know that if your GFR is under 30, then you can't kick your protein up to this level of 1.2 to 1.5. So GFR under 30 means you have severe kidney disease, but just about everybody over 80 is labeled as having mild kidney disease, because our GFR declines with age, and that doesn't mean that you have a problem digesting protein or managing the nitrogen. So that particular concept is a little bit overblown, and I want to just say that what we want to do, to the extent that it's possible in talking about diet, is be evidence-based. Now, if you are a vegan and or a vegetarian who is exclusively using soy, and perhaps you have nut allergies, so you're not getting any protein from nuts, you're going to need a little extra leucine to maintain that muscle mass. And maybe about 2.5 grams of leucine a day, that's what the recommendations are. You want to try and keep those branched chain amino acids, of which leucine is one, high. And so if eggs and fish, for your pescatarians out there, eggs and fish are also low in leucine. And after I read this, which was maybe a year ago, I started adding a half a teaspoon of leucine powder to my morning shake, because I was primarily at that point a pescatarian. Now I'm eating more meat because I'm doing some detox. And if anyone wants to ask me about that, that would be a perfectly good reason to call in. But diets high in protein have been shown to improve body composition, that is to say muscle to fat ratio, blood sugar regulation, that is to say insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome, and possibly sleep quality. But remember, if you're eating muscles that belonged to an animal, you're eating what that animal ate, and that includes hormones, and it includes antibiotics, and it includes things that might bioaccumulate, such as plastics, dioxins, mercury. So it's good to have a varied diet, as wide a variation as you can manage, and it's good to watch your protein levels as you age. So just as a kind of index for the protein stuff, you know, you could go and look it up, but if you're trying to ballpark it, weigh it, okay? If it's meat, that is to say gravity-bearing protein, if the thing you're eating was walking around on the planet, then there are 7 grams, there are, 1 ounce has 7 grams of protein. So that's your beef, your lamb, your pork, et cetera, et cetera. If it, rabbit, chicken, if it's walking, it's 7 grams of protein, 7 grams of protein per ounce. If it's fish, it's a little less. It's 5 grams of protein per ounce. And fish don't walk, they swim. If it's an egg, same thing. Didn't walk, it didn't swim, didn't do much except sit there and get, well, no, I'm not going to say it. But that egg is 5 grams of protein per ounce. And off the top of my head, I have no idea how many ounces there are in an egg. In terms of protein powders, whey is considered best if you're trying to build muscles. Egg and beef powders, so that sort of powdered bone broth, is also a good one to use. Sardines, also a good source of omega-3s, but I have yet, if somebody has a recipe for making sardines palatable, let me know. The canned variety are the ones that are, it's just a bridge too far for me at the moment. Let's see if we can get to our first caller. Again, the number 900-5773. We are going to Roseanne in New Jersey. Hello, Roseanne. Can you hear me?
Okay.
What can I do for you?
I've been just found out some information about a product called Curederm. It's a BEC5 from a devil's apple. I was listening to Dr. Josh Axe. He had this whole program in Asia, 7 days in 7 countries. And apparently this product is over-the-counter for skin cancer. And my question was, I have used Fudex in the past, and I was wondering if you know about this product and what the difference is between that and an Fudex product.
Okay, well, I'm trying to find ingredients. I have not heard of this. Purederm, unfortunately, is turning up a bunch of different products. Bear with me for a second, and
sure.
Let's see. Hold on, love. Let me just see. No, the problem is that there's a company called Purederm that makes a bunch of stuff. So what did you say was the active ingredient?
B's and boy, E, C's and Charles, 5.
Okay, let's try BCE5.
BEC.
Yeah. Did I mean BEC5? Okay,
right.
Solazodine glycosides. All right, that sounds like an actual chemical. And
yes.
Topical treatment with very low concentrations of a standard mixture of solazodine glycosides. All right, so this is a compound that can be, that, yeah, this is the stuff. So it's similar to 5-FU, and I'm not sure whether it is also a DNA toxin, which is what 5-FU does, but it clearly does kill off skin cancers. So if you use a product like this, at low levels for a long period of time, the concern that one would have would be whether or not you would get skin cancer from it, because it would be, it could be mildly mutagenic. On the other hand, if you were to use it over a short period, let's say 6 to 8 weeks, to clear a bunch of age spots and maybe some of those actinic keratoses, that would probably be okay, because you wouldn't be doing it over the long term. The use of 5-FU to clear cancers has been around for a long time. And this, I think, is relatively new, although this paper is dated 1991. The real question I would have, and I certainly can't, you know, do the due diligence search over the phone right now on live on the air, because I'd have to shut up and read, and you'd be bored while I did that. Everybody would be bored. So instead, what I will say is, I think if your specific goal is rejuvenation, you could use it for a short period of time. Long-term daily use might have a problem. I would never have people use Fudex. I would have people use Retin A or glycolic acid or one of the other well-established safety profile things. Because remember, this thing got through the FDA on the basis of clearing skin cancers. So you have a risk and you have a benefit. And when you're treating cancer successfully without, freezing 100 lesions on someone's face, there's a real serious benefit. On the other hand, if what you're treating is wrinkles, then the risk has to be much lower, because the benefit is a cosmetic one. And while as an extremely vain person, I think cosmetic benefit is a very big deal, I wouldn't trade it for a cancer. You know what I mean? So so I think you could use this as a pathway to getting somewhere, and then you would want to use other agents like sunscreens and vitamin C, like vitamin C esters, which are very good for keeping things faded and very safe. Another thing that's good, what are we treating? What are you using it for?
I'm treating more basal and squamous, and on the show, PubMed had an article, and the doctor interviewed over in Asia was speaking about this back in 2015.
Right, and that
so
makes
I don't know.
No, that makes sense. So, like I said, that's exactly the indication for the 5-FU that you've already tried.
Right, but this Curederm is also supposed to be used for the same thing.
Right, and so it certainly would be a very reasonable thing for you to do. I don't know. Let's see. They were using a 10% concentration in this study, but they have a
product that contained a very low concentration, 0.005%. And they were saying that's the effect, that was effective.
Okay.
So I think if, let me give you this reference and you can go maybe get a hold of the actual article and look in the methods section and see how they used it. Did they apply it twice a day? La, la, la. How long did they treat
for?
Okay. So that is cancer, L-E-T-T, that's cancer letters, 1991. September 59, parentheses 3, page 183 to 192.
Okay, I'll have my son read that. He's a lawyer. He can read it better than I will.
Oh, did you hear me spell L-A-W-Y-E-R earlier?
Earlier, and I was hysterical laughing.
Good. Well, you'll have to try that. You'll have to tell him about the radio doctor who dare not say the name of his profession.
Okay. And what was interesting about the Curaderm, it's over the counter. You don't need a prescription, where Effudex, you have to go to the doctor and get a prescription. So I thought that was interesting.
It's interesting. Yeah, there's some backstory there. All right, well, thank you so much for your call.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Keep listening. This email from Julia. Oh, before I read Julia's email, let me just say that I love getting emails. Actually, from you guys, I love getting emails. I don't love all emails. That would be a lie. But that was a good vocal burr. Okay, so I love getting your emails, and you can email me at askdrdawn.com. You just go there and click on the contact us, and there's a little box that'll pop up, and I would love to hear from you. That's also my Twitter handle, the at symbol and then Ask Dr. Dawn. And I do look at my Twitter messages, but not live on the air. I haven't quite developed that level of multitasking. Not sure I ever will, but please give me a call. Anyway, Julia in Santa Cruz writes, recycled plastic health risk. I love the idea of reusing recycling plastics, but are there considerations that you advise to avoid health risks? Some product examples are cloth made of recycled plastic fibers, building materials such as Trek, and even comforter and pillow stuffing. I know the BPA-free labeling on some products is not protecting us against all known harmful chemicals. Recycling mixes the materials, and chemical makeup seems impossible to know. Well, we could check it with mass spectrometry, Julia, but she's just wondering about this, and I think this raises a really interesting question. I would stay away so far, far away from pillows and blankets made of this, because as they deteriorate, we may run into the same problem that we're running into with the fire retardants in foam. And so any plastic materials that are in that pillow, you know, they're going to, as the foam breaks down, they're going to come through the covering. And that covering, they're going to come through the covering, and that covering is going to create an issue. So from the standpoint of other items, you mentioned Trex. Well, if I was cutting Trex with a saw, I'd probably wear a dust mask while I did it. I'd probably also wear that dust mask if I were cutting redwood. Don't breathe it. Don't breathe it is probably the key message here. So if it's clothing, I think it's okay. I do worry about how stable these are, and, you know, are we putting more plastic into the ocean in the form of microplastic bubbles when we wash clothing that's made of recycled plastic? I have no idea. And it never occurred to me to even wonder about that before. I'll see if I can find any data with a web search and get back to you with more information if I find it. Thank you, Julia, in Santa Cruz, for your provocative and interesting question. And we are now going to our next caller, and that is Carrie in Capitola. Hello, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
Hi. I had a question about brain tumors.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if you know anything about shrinking them, shrinking them rather than cutting them out.
Well, I'm not an oncologist. I do know some general things about it. I will tell you a story about one of my patients who came in. He was probably 26, .com guy, this many years ago. He came in with headaches, And he described some really interesting phenomenon. He said, when I get my headache, my vision gets jumpy, like one of those old-fashioned, old-timey movies where you can sort of see the shutter speed, and it'll happen during the time I've got the headache, and then my vision will go back to normal. And I said, oh, well, that's very interesting. We need to get a head scan, because that's not a headache. That's a weird thing for a migraine. And head scans were hard to get, and there was only one MRI machine in the entire county, and it was on a trailer, and it would go between Watsonville and Santa Cruz. And at that moment, it was down in Watsonville, so I sent him down there, and I got a frantic call from the tech who said, this guy's got a big brain tumor. And I'm like, okay, well, I need to get him back to the office, and I don't want him driving. So this was pre-Uber. Anyway, long story short, his brain tumor was not resectable. That is to say, it couldn't be reached by surgery. So they used something called a gamma knife, which is a ray gun, really, shooting alpha particles. And so I think the gamma knife shoots alpha particles. Anyway, you actually have this radioactive substance that you beam into the brain, and you have two or three angles. And so the place where the beams cross is where you get enough power to destroy tissue. But the places where the beams cross through to get there, because things are deep in the brain, they heat up and they get unhappy, but they don't die. So you can make the death occur only where you target it by using two or three different beams. And this has become a very standard technical oncology therapy. Now, so that's a way of getting to brain tumors that can't be resected. In terms of natural things to shrink brain tumors, I don't go there, because I believe in prayer, and I believe in wishful thinking, and I believe in intention, and I believe in meditation, but I'm not going to mess around with a brain tumor and those things. I don't believe anecdotes, and even if the anecdote is true and that person was blessed by the universe or by whatever deity or entity you believe in, you can't rely. You know, one does not jump out of an airplane without a parachute and pray to the Lord to hold them up. That the Lord is likely to decide that they need a reboot. And so that's kind of what I'm saying here. Does that answer your question? Let me see if you have a follow-up.
There's nothing, like herbs or any kind of, you know, like that, that you, or nutritional supplements that, act to shrink it. I mean, I know there are like, you know, some things that can help to shrink it, but,
you know,
nothing like really
natural, stuff is not powerful. Okay, natural. When you get to the point where you have a cancer,
it's actually a benign tumor.
A benign tumor. Okay, well, that's better.
But it's still, you know, in the brain, right. And they've already operated once on it and taken it out, and then they've taken most of it out, and then now it's growing back, and they have to, you know, they need to take it out again pretty soon. And so I just was wondering,
there is a little bit of data for prostate cancer, low-grade prostate cancer, and a couple of other cancers in humans. And so I'm going to tell you the best things that you can do, all right, which is not to say it's going to work. But we have this concept that if you shift the environment that you can affect the, let's call it the programming of something. Now, this thing obviously is programmed to grow. So the question is, can you program it can you unprogram it to grow, or can you shift the programming? And it really partly depends on whether you're already eating a healthy diet with lots of vegetables, or whether you're the fast food nation guy. And the fast food nation guy has a much better chance of this working, because his tumor grew up in an environment of high saturated fats and lots of sugar and gluten. And in that circumstance, if you suddenly go like totally paleo, keto, vegan, you know, pick one, but you drastically shift the environment, that you may confuse the cancer enough that it kind of gets stunned into not growing. And we do see in the prostate cancer studies, because you can do a biopsy on the prostate pretty easily, excuse my grammar. When you do a study where you change the diet radically and start meditating and start exercising and take out all the crap, you can watch the cancers actually shift in the direction of being less aggressive. And that's established, biopsy-proven stuff.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, there are things you can do. I generally steer people towards something called the spectrum diet, which is something that was created by Dean Ornish. And then on top of that, you need, you know, to try to get 9 or 10 hours of sleep a day, and you need to cut your stress to zero. And I usually put people on, when I'm dealing with people who are cancer survivors with a chance of the cancer coming back, this is what I do. And There's no way I can prove it works, but there's enough data to make it worth doing if the person is sufficiently motivated. And like I said, depending on how much of a shift it is, my optimism for success goes up to the extent that they really are shifting.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay. So
yeah, it's not me. It's a friend. But I was just listening to Hi and Charlene. They did like a tour in Asia, and I didn't get to see it all, but I was just thinking, like, maybe they, you know, talked to a doctor in Asia. That's why it kind of came up to me in my mind. And then,
you know,
also, my friend is just about, you know, going into the possibility of having to have it taken out again.
Sure. Well, one other thing I didn't recommend that I will tell you, since you raised played the Asia card there, is that they use a lot of Qigong in Asia, and I visited something called the People's Traditional Hospital in China in 1984 and talked to the oncologist. This was when I was a medical student, and so I was pretty skeptical and pretty snarky and thought I knew everything. I didn't, at that point, I didn't buy it. Later on, I learned Qigong, and I had some personal experiences that showed me that my brain had shifted into a really interesting space with the Qigong. So I began to think, well, maybe this is actually more powerful than I gave it credit for, but I never really went back and looked to see what emerged and what's been published on Qigong and cancer. And obviously you can't do placebo meditation or placebo Qigong, so you've got two different groups. But it's a really good way to get your stress level down. And so maybe one thing that your friend could use, whether or not she goes back under the knife or not, is to study and practice Qigong, because it won't hurt. It might help. And I will tell you, it's a great stress reducer. That I'm clear on.
Okay. That's a good recommendation. I've done it before, and I love it.
And when you have a brain tumor, you need all the stress reduction you can get, whether it's benign or otherwise.
Yeah, and she has a lot of anxiety without the brain tumor.
Yeah, duh, of course she does, and it's understandable. Yeah. But it's also potentially feeding the beast. That's what all the natural medicine stuff is about. To the extent that you're feeding the beast, stop feeding the beast.
Mm-hmm.
So the diet that feeds cancer, stop it. You know, the stress that impairs your immune system function, get rid of it. Stop feeding the beast.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. And I appreciate that you really wanted, you know, I know we all want to find that magic bullet. God.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course we do.
Magic bullet. Natural magic bullet.
Well, a lot of people.
Gamma ray.
Yeah. Look into that. It's actually the gamma knife, and
gamma knife.
Yeah, and that's actually I was wrong about it. It's a particle, but I don't know what the name of the particle is. It's not alpha particles, because I just got that. That's cobalt, and so not a physicist. Not. You know. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
Bye bye.
I have one more email while we're waiting for our next call. Jean writes, Risks of radiation therapy for breast cancer. My family has a history of heart problems in the senior years. I'm 63 years old and recently had a partial mastectomy on my left side and a lumpectomy. Soon it will be time for radiation treatments. As OSHA requires people to leave the room, and it is admitted that the room is filled with radiation, it's hard for me to accept that my heart would not be affected by radiation treatments directly targeted at the area, putting my heart in harm's way. The heart, too, is on the left side. Yes, Jeannie, it is an issue, and I have some strong suggestions for you with respect to this situation. The point is, your risk of recurrence of the cancer is fairly high if you don't get the radiation. That's been established, and you don't want to forego the radiation, really, you don't, even though it will invariably create some increase in your lifetime risk of developing coronary artery disease. They work very hard to kind of hit the breast and graze the heart and not go, so they usually have two or three beams going, like I was talking before about with the Gamma Knife, and that's good. That helps. But you're still going to get some scatter off the ribs, and you're going to get some dose. And one of the reasons that we started changing the way we do chest irradiation was because we figured out, oh, wait, we're kicking up the coronary artery disease risk in this population. So what can you do? You can lower your coronary artery disease risk by getting very, very big on anti-inflammatories. Now, you presumably are doing preventative radiation, so you can do lots of anti-inflammatories after the therapy, not during, but after. And during the therapy, I would probably take either a statin or red yeast rice and watch my HSCRP, which is a high-sensitivity C-reactive protein. It's an inflammatory test. You don't tell me whether you're diabetic, but if you have diabetes, this would be the time to wear your halo and be perfect in terms of following your diet. And because keep the insulin down, keeps the inflammation down. An anti-inflammatory diet, which is to say lots and lots of fruits and vegetables and healthy fats, has not ever been associated with interfering with chemotherapy or radiation therapy. There is no data whatsoever. In fact, there's data to the contrary. So it is beneficial for you. It will not hurt your chances of success with the radiation. High doses of antioxidants, particularly green tea, maybe green tea is actually powerful enough to protect you from radiation. Maybe miso is actually powerful enough to protect you from radiation. I'd stay away from both of those while I'm getting radiation therapy that I want to work. But as soon as it's over, start loading up on these exact compounds. And how long to stay on the red yeast rice will depend on what your inflammatory levels are. And you might want to consider staying on this stuff over the long haul. But if you do take either a statin or red yeast rice, be sure that you also take coenzyme Q10, at least 200, ideally 300 milligrams a day, because that protects you from the adverse side effects. Oh, wait, did I say that a natural substance has adverse side effects? Yes, I did, because when you take these things at the kind of doses that are recommended, 2,400 milligrams a day, for example, for red yeast rice, you're no longer taking a dietary substance. You've weaponized that dietary substance, or rather an extract of it, and you can expect it to act like a drug. It's gone from being nutrition to nutraceutical, and there's nothing wrong with that. But just because it's natural doesn't mean that it's safe. Some of the best poisons are derived from natural compounds. And, you know, oleander leaf comes to mind. You can actually kill somebody with a tea made of oleander leaves. I'm sure that's public knowledge, so I don't think I've created any problems there. But nobody does that unless they want to kill somebody because it's traceable, and they'll figure it out. We've got 10 minutes left, so I've got lots of little tidbits here, but we have time to talk about some science. So let's look at an article about pain. I like this pain journal. It's called Practical Pain Management, and it's aimed at primary care doctors, also pain management doctors. You've probably heard about abdominal adhesions, and people with adhesions often have pain when they twist or when they when their bowel is full or certain movements. Some people with adhesions around the bladder will have problems when their bladder's full or when they empty the bladder. They'll get kind of a spiky pain up in the under the liver, and it's like, what's going on? Well, the part of the bowel that should be attached up there under the liver at the ligament of Treitz is under tension because the lower part of it down by the appendix has gotten attached to the bladder. And so when the bladder moves suddenly down, it yanks on your bowel and you get a tug that you can sometimes localize in the upper quadrant. The conventional wisdom is that you don't do surgery for adhesions because the surgery will make the adhesions worse. And every time someone has an abdominal operation, we sort of expect there to be adhesions. It's sort of inevitable. And sometimes they're neutral and they don't cause problem, but a certain percentage of the time, they are a problem. Well, so for people with abdominal adhesions, a new therapy called ultrasound-guided hydrodissection is showing some real promise. And it's been also been used to treat carpal tunnel syndrome, which I think is super interesting. And so we're gonna just follow through on this case study of a woman with a history of breast cancer. And after her mastectomies and breast reduction, she had to have something called a tram flap, where a part of the abdominal muscles were moved up to cover the breast. And she'd also had spinal surgery. And after her surgeries, even though they were done on the chest, she began having worsening abdominal pain, and she couldn't move or twist, particularly raising her right shoulder because it would hurt too much. And she went through just about everything, natural, unnatural, yoga, Pilates, Rolfing, deep tissue massage, trigger point release, and she just didn't get anywhere. The pain that you're thinking of in these cases is crushing, vice-like, like a very, very tight band, and intermittent muscle spasms. That's or intermittent bowel spasms. Those are the sort of things where this is going to happen. In this case of this patient, what the doctors did was they actually squirted high pressure water through where the muscle was attached to the surrounding tissues, and they were able to separate the fibers. They had to do it every 2 weeks for 12 weeks, but it was curative. And this can also be done in the abdominal wall. So when people have abdominal wall adhesions, this therapy, and I'll tell you again, it's called hydrodissection. Hydrodissection for lysis of adhesions is a promising new therapy, and I'm pleased and happy to bring it to your attention. I am just looking to see where you might find it. And I see that the article, the author of this article is in Texas. I suspect that the Stanford Pain Clinic will probably be up on this. And let's go ahead and move to another article. Let's get on a soapbox for a moment here. That's always fun at the end of the hour. This is from December of this year, and I've been sitting on it waiting for my moment. The American Diabetic Association releases guidelines for type 2 diabetes care in children and teens. And this is tricky because this is a new phenomenon. When I trained in medical school, and if you go back and look at 1980s medical textbooks, there was no type 2 diabetes in children and teens. It didn't exist. It wasn't in the medical textbooks. And there's a reason for that. Something has changed. Yes, we have more obesity. I think that is another symptom, not a cause of this. Something has drastically changed. BPA is a candidate. A lot of the plastics in the food, also potential candidates. But basically what the ADA is saying is that this is common enough now that any child who's overweight should be screened for diabetes every 3 years after the age of, starting at the age of 10. And we should be watching, and then if they have an abnormal finding, you want to check for antibodies against the pancreas, because those could be the beginning of type 1 diabetes, and we can stop type 1 diabetes in its tracks now. We know by using the same drugs that are used to prevent tumor rejection, but we use them in lower doses. Some of the rheumatoid arthritis drugs are also being looked at for this, but those are very heavy drugs to give to a kid. On the other hand, type 1 diabetes is a very heavy illness, and it looks like treatment for about a year is all you need. Whatever is driving the type 1 diabetes evaporates. It's kind of an interesting thing, type 1, because if you have identical twins growing up in the identical environment, the risk of the identical twin getting type 1 diabetes, if one twin does, is the same as the risk of any other sibling getting type 1 diabetes, which is around 4 to 5%, if I'm remembering correctly. On the other hand, if you have a sibling with type 2 diabetes, your risk of getting type 2 diabetes is about 40 to 60%. So that's another group that should be getting screening. And so when we talk about diabetes, the type 2 diabetes in children, you start thinking about, my goodness, what about all those long-term complications of diabetes that are going to happen if you're using this agent for more than, well, if you've got diabetes for 60, 70 years, that your chances of getting, of being in good control through your teens, it's very challenging. So by the time a person gets to their 20s, they may already be showing signs of some kidney problems, setting them up for maybe dialysis, setting them up for high-risk pregnancies. This truly is a public health crisis. And during the Obama administration, Michelle Obama made this her thing, because the African-American and the Hispanic communities are disproportionately involved. I should also say the South Asian communities, people from India, Pakistan, and also people from Far Asia are more at risk. And this goes to epigenetics. Did your grandparents starve? Well, if your grandparents experienced famine, your chances of having a problem are much, much greater. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.